Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Penelope Caulfield. Penelope is Professor of History at Royal Holloway, London University, and President of the International Society for 18th Century Studies. Her previous books include Time in the Shape of History and Power and the Professions in Britain 1700 to 1850. I'm going to be talking to her about The Georgians, the deeds and misdeeds of 18th century Britain, which was published on the 25th of January. Penelope, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We're here to talk about your new book, The Georgians, the deeds and misdeeds of the 18th century. So the book's title is The Georgians. I just wanted to ask as an initial question to get into talking about the book, when did people start using that term to refer to the people who lived in the 18th century and the long 18th century?
That's such a good question, because they didn't, of course, use that term in the 18th century itself. And ideally, I would have preferred a term from the 18th century, but it's first used immediately after the death of George IV in 1832, so they are looking back retrospectively on the Georgians. So I thought, I just need one big term. You can't say every time, all the people who lived in the 18th century, whether they moved there or moved from there, you know, it's just too capacious. So I wanted one big noun. And then I thought, is it one that would outrage them? And they would understand what it meant. And they would accept it rather than calling them, for example, the Hanoverians. They wouldn't have liked that at all, because they would have viewed Hanover as British Hanover rather than themselves as Hanoverian Britons. So I chose the Georgians. It can be mistaken with people from the Republic of Georgia or the American state of Georgia, all of which are devoted to St. George, but nonetheless, in context, it's always clear. And the people who'd be most annoyed are the people from the late 17th century, because I start from the 1680s. I took 6 generations of people working through from the 1680s to the 1840s, and they would have no idea what the term meant, but I had to have something.
Yes, of course, because when people talk about the 18th century, scholars and literary critics and everything, they're often talking about the long 18th century, which goes from the Glorious Revolution onwards, which does it make it a slightly baggier and more capacious term, doesn't it? Yeah, 100 years are not 100 years anymore.
Though they did know about, they were very interested in time, the Georgians, and they counted the centuries. This is the period when counting the centuries first came in, so they would have known themselves as the 18th century, and there was a lot of celebration at the turn of the century between 1800 and 1801.
So you mentioned there that the Georgians would have hated to be referred to as the Hanoverian Britons, and that's because the 18th century is also the period in which Britishness kind of begins to be formed. I mean, you have the new constitutional monarchy with Queen Anne and everything. Do you want to speak a bit about how it's kind of a crucible for Britishness, maybe?
I certainly do, but I do stress alongside this is a period of multiple identities. So the traditional identities of Scotland, England, Wales, Ireland do not disappear by any means. In fact, in a way, there's almost an escalation of joking and laughing and caricaturing, but it's alongside the growth of the concept of Britain and Britannia. And again, some of the sections of society are more ambivalent, especially in Ireland. But nonetheless, it's a collective identity which has a great impact on forging the, not quite the unity, but the interactions between the traditional kingdoms. And one of the reasons I consider this is such a period of cultural ferment, I mean, there are several reasons, but one big one is the interaction of the three traditional kingdoms, and a lot of the 18th century Enlightenment Scottish, a lot of literary, cultural, dramatic work, is musical, is from Ireland. You know, there's a tremendous fusion of the kingdoms, with all the tensions, like sibling tensions, that implies. But it is an interesting period, and this is when Britannia and the British Lion first emerge.
Yes, and isn't it that Dr. Johnson's very, very famously disparaging of the Scots and was quite rude about David Hume because of that? Yeah, lots of tension.
Yes, that's right. Although, again, like a lot of these tensions, they're all quite personally pally with people from these other backgrounds. Boswell Johnson's great friend is a Scot, So these tensions are partly matters of joke and tradition, and they work partly by pressing on traditional cultural vibes. It's a form of social identification or recognition, and people don't sort of build great structures on that. There's no move to expel Scotland from the Union, for example, or later Ireland. It's welcomed.
Yeah, even with the Revolutionary Wars later on in the period, when there's a kind of more of a fervour there. Yeah, difficulty with Scotland. So your book makes a great number of links between the 18th and the 21st centuries. Each chapter ends with a kind of time shift moment, which is brilliant because you have, you quote somebody earlier on in the book saying, everyone loves a Georgian house. We very much live with the Georgians very present in our lives. I mean, if you walk down the Thames today, there's Alexander Pope in Twickenham, there's a statue of Capability Brown in Hammersmith. The Georgians are everywhere. And although, you know, we don't have the same clothes, we're not at war with revolutionary France, what are the similarities between our two centuries?
Yes, I'm always fascinated by the overlaps in history and also the differences. There are differences as well, but there are far more overlaps than people realise. You might have mentioned, for example, Georgians on our banknotes, a tremendous number of those. But two of the sort of underlying things that I would mention are ones that people don't think of at all, like traditions. Well, actually, three I can think of. One is the traditions of eating. For example, fast food comes in the 18th century in busy urban commercial societies, particularly the sandwich, named after the Earl of Sandwich, which is now globally known. And of course has a globally dazzling array of fillings, whereas the first sandwiches were a slice of beef between bread. But the concept of urban industrial society, life on the move, that's very Georgian, and in a different way now too. So that's one thing I would mention. Another that I'm really interested in, not that I'm not interested in the sandwich either, but another speciality of the Georgian. This is not when the handshake was invented, but when it first spreads very significantly throughout society. And this is a really interesting development, because it's often said that cultural change and styles and manners come from the top and trickle down. And this is absolutely the reverse. It comes from the middle and sort of fountains up and down. And it's in commercial, industrial, and actually diplomatic society. People shake hands. It's an equal measure. You look each other in the eye, you extend the arm, you don't impinge on people's body space. It's a really interesting form of greeting that we still keep, with the problems of COVID set aside, in the long-term trend we still keep. And that is a more egalitarian society, again, urban, industrial, which is quite an interesting, well, the significant new development of social mores. And at the same time, the old-fashioned deep bowing and the deep curtsying are disappearing, except at court. And even there, there's some lovely stories. The deep curtsy, especially before later clothing becomes more streamlined and women's clothing becomes more streamlined. But the old days with the big, big, wide bodices and frameworks and huge materials, it took a lot of effort to hold your back upright and sink down and get up again. So the page boys used to run up behind the old ladies and hold them as they did this manoeuvre out of sight of the monarch, because it's actually quite a difficult thing to do. But outside the court, by the end of the 18th century, that's all virtually disappeared. And one of the things that makes me laugh in TV and film reconstructions, they always look at the etiquette books and they make people behave as though they were at the court of St. James, you know, deep reverences and all that. And by the end of the 18th century, it's much, much more relaxed and casual. Although, of course, it's still polite. This is still a very polite society, but it's a different set of mores. So fast food, egalitarian handshakes, and the culture of experimentation, trial and error. And that is very, very British. But it has to include, I keep warning people, it has to include error. And when you realise you've made an error, correcting it.
That's brilliant. And you talk about how both of those, I suppose, in a way, are part of a more egalitarian culture developing. And in the book, you talk about how the 18th century is kind of the formation of meritocracy, in a sense. We have a greater degree of social change than perhaps in previous centuries. And Adrian Wooldridge's book on the age of meritocracy, talking about our age as a meritocratic one, recently came out, I think, a couple of months ago. How did meritocracy develop? Was it as are we a meritocratic society? That's actually too hard a question. I can't ask you if we're a meritocratic society now, but were they a meritocratic society?
I don't think, actually, there's ever been a perfectly meritocratic society, because in the strictest theory, everybody would start from nowhere, as it were, and the most meritocratic would emerge, whereas we still keep titles, inherited wealth, and all the rest. So they did in the 18th century. So some of these meritocrats are gaining titles or marrying title families and merging into the plutocracy or the aristocracy. And they don't start from scratch. Their children have all the advantages, wealth and social position. So I wouldn't say it was anything like a perfect meritocracy. And no such society has ever existed. And whether it is completely right, well, that's a whole different issue, as you're saying, because as they said in the film Billy Elliot, we can't all be Billy Elliots. What about the rest? You know, you can't just take up the most brilliant or most meritorious, depending on how you define merit. But certainly there was a great surge of people from middling and lower class backgrounds coming through in the 18th century, partly because of the great spread of literacy and numeracy. This was unlocking talents in the population as a whole that had been there latently, but were all allowed to come through. And there's a tremendous surge in schooling, well ahead of the state instituting universal schooling. There's a tremendous thirst for learning. And so, you know, it's often difficult. Dr. Johnson has a poem about how difficult it is to be, you know, brilliant but poor. You have to struggle to come through. But many more people are coming through. There's also bitterness from those who feel they have the ability but don't make it. So it's very competitive society. It's not all joy and happiness. But it's partly because there's this surge of talents coming through, but also because the system recognises that it needs these abilities. And I give you the most clear example. The army and navy are both great areas where meritocrats come through, because in a battle, you don't want Sir Somebody or Other who's the son of Sir Somebody or Other. If they can't fight a battle, you want the person who can fight and win. So the army is a great source of meritocratic advancement, because Britain's at war a lot and it wins a lot, not all the time, but it does so because it advances meritocrats who know how to fight, and not just to fight, but to inspire the men.
Yeah. And so that sense of meritocracy is also tied to the sense of progress, then, if we have the development of literacy, the development of industry in so many ways. And obviously you can't talk about the 18th century without mentioning empire. And in your book, you're kind of sceptical that it was a plan for empire. It was more opportunistic in the way that it developed. And also, I suppose one of the failings of meritocracy there is that the people were very, very, very disparaging of them. Are they nabobs or nabobs who come back from empire with their wealth? Do you want to speak a bit about the development of empire in the 18th century?
Yes, it's my view, and I don't think I'm unique in this, that there certainly wasn't any planned empire. There's a whole mix of trading contacts, settlements in less intensely settled areas, etc., which gradually coalesce. And I think, as I say in the book, the first references to empire, there's quite a lot of references, but it's almost always to Britain's commercial empire and trading empire, like as Britannia rules the waves. You know, they never claim to be ruling the world. But it spreads partly because there are power vacuums in the areas that are spreading, but partly because also the state does follow up and defend the interests of trade, and the East India Company develops an army, etc., etc. So, you know, it's not completely passive in this, but it's not a plan. And I also make the point, there never is a British emperor. But the only title that comes in 1876, not in the Georgian era, is given to Victoria as the Empress of India. And there was a debate then, should she be made Empress of Britain? And there was a strong, strong objection, because that was a more totalitarian model of monarchy and leadership. And that is not how they viewed things. But nonetheless, the holdings and plantations and trading settlements do eventually coalesce. The first reference in a statute is in 1801, when they refer to the British Empire, but meaning sort of hegemony, rather than organised territories. And then it just developed, but not, I don't mean completely passively, there's a lot of aggression, but not a plan.
Definitely. Well, isn't it true that the EIC with its debts, the East India Company with its debts, almost makes the government fall a crazy number of times, the whole Lord North scandal and everything there? It's not It's not a national plan for empire. They were opportunistic businessmen. So obviously you can't talk about the empire and all of that without mentioning slavery as well, which was a large presence in the 18th century. And I think you mentioned really well in the book that we might think of, you know, Britain's history as being quite traditionally white in a sense, but there were other people in England at the time and in Scotland and Ireland and Wales. But how, to what extent do you think that we can be kind of moralistic and judgmental of the Georgians for the slavery that went on in the 18th century?
It's a really, really good and central question, because history is the great storehouse of experience for humans. So we have to learn from it, but that does include judging as well as everything else, deciding, understanding, and we have to make judgments. Otherwise, the criminal justice system wouldn't ever operate if you can't make judgments about the past. But rather like in the criminal justice system, you really have to have evidence. And it, what I'm quite happy to debate the Georgians, but I'm not happy with people who just say simply, oh, all the good old days or all the bad old days. That's not really judging, that's just making sweeping prejudiced assumptions. So it would be wrong to think, you know, all the 18th century are supporters of slavery and racist to boot. Although, again, many were, but it's quite interesting how attitudes change. I'm taking a long span period, and what would be standard in 1680s, it would be quite different in 1840, partly because with the opening up of the world and the spreading of literacy and the press, people suddenly became aware. But to those people who are very judgmental about the Georgians, I actually say, well, what do you know about the conditions that the workers work in, who produce the food and drink and clothes that you consume? There's a lot of slavery in the world today, but people are often unaware of how this impinges on their consumption. So in the early 18th century, people were just unaware. Yeah. And in the course of time, the brilliant campaigning from the abolitionists, and they were very, very, you know, mass campaigns with prints and medals and posters, and really, really active campaigning. There were more and more societies across Britain who were, first of all, against the slave trade and then moving on for the abolition of slavery anywhere under the British flag, as it were. And this is quite interesting because the British state didn't actually run the slave trade, but it ruled legally in 1807 that no one under the British flag should participate, and then it started policing the high seas to prevent other slavers, so that it was moving into international as well as national regulation in quite a substantial way on an issue of principle. Now again, there's lots of ways, criticisms to be made of the way the actual emancipation was done in 1833, but nonetheless it was done. And on your other point, were there people of different origins in 18th century Britain? The answer is far, far more than we ever suspected. And not only people coming in from Europe and from Ireland, but from all around the world. And very interesting to see what sort of receptions they got. And of course, they did run into prejudice, but they also settled and managed as well, and tended to be, it's a bit of a generalisation, but you can imagine how this would work, tended to be easier in the big cities, and it was more difficult if someone from Africa, say, is travelling in a remote village where they're not used to seeing strangers like that. In fact, some English people travelling to remote villages would say that strangers weren't welcome, so people from afar. But if you look at prints of the era, it's very interesting, without any point being made, a print of a crowd would quite likely have a number of dark faces in it as well, without making a point, but just as a description. And others have done more work on this, but I started to study some of the leading Africans and Caribbeans who we know came to Britain, just to follow what happened to them. And some are more bitter about the discrimination they faced, and others were very genial about it. But they all settled and stayed. And interestingly, many of the ones we know about married English women. We know about men mainly. And they married English women, and their children, you know, their descendants, are living among Britain today. So there's a lot of assimilation. And the obverse of racism and discrimination is intermarriage. And that's the sort of hidden secret in human history. Everywhere humans go, there are a lot of tensions and so forth, but there's also a lot of intermarriage, as the geneticists are always telling us.
Yeah, so it's kind of an age of more multiculturalism than we might expect. You talk also about the French Huguenots coming over as well, which is also quite an important sense of different cultures mixing.
Yes, yeah. It usually happens, and we've got quite a lot of documentation on the Huguenots, and of course, because they were fellow Protestants, they were very welcome in Protestant circles, but usually in the households, they spoke French for the first generation. Then in the second generation, they would speak French in the household, but English outside. Then by the third generation, they'd all be speaking English, though French Huguenot surnames can be found everywhere across the, throughout the English-speaking world, there are Huguenot surnames. Yeah. And someone like David Garrick, the famous actor of the age, was second generation from Huguenot immigrant family, but the name is anglicised and he's thought of as classically Anglo. And of course his mother comes from Lichfield, so there's all this intermarriage going on all the time.
And to talk about David Garrick, the 18th century is in many ways an age of the theatre really coming into its own after, if you have Restoration comedies and then 18th century drama after that, it's all of the 18th century adaptations of Shakespeare, really bawdy plays as well, and everything going on.
Yes, and remember too, not only in the big theatres, and indeed little theatres, wonderful array of Georgian theatres around the country to this day, but also the actors went on tour all the time, so these were being discovered and accessible. And the theatre, of course, is a tremendous vehicle for both literate and illiterate audiences can come and enjoy them. So they really are appealing. And of course, as the tide of literacy is rising, there are, of course, a lot of illiterates, but they can they join in songs, they can look at prints, and they can go to the theatres. And there's some quite surprising little details. Like there were, a barn collapsed in Preston, and 300 people were killed, and they'd gone to watch a play. You know, we just discover little details like that. Otherwise, we had no idea. But people go to watch these things because, of course, they can, there's no TV, there's no radio. The theatre and song are the equivalent of TV and radio for the day, and they're very, very vital and lively.
And because it is an age, if you do have a great degree of illiterate people as well, the growing literacy and the Spectator and the Tatler are set up in the 18th century. Bridgerton, as everyone watched Last Christmas, has Lady Whistledown, who's an anonymous gossip and columnist, but maybe she's like Eliza Haywood or Della Riviere Manley. You know, it's an age of such papery writing everywhere. Everyone's writing about everything all the time, which is kind of brilliant. I mean, so much of our literary culture, coffeehouse culture, so much of, you know, your book was reviewed in The Spectator yesterday, The Times, The Daily Mail. Maybe that stems from the 18th century as well.
Yeah. Yes, the press is a fascinating element of it all. But in a way, what I'm also talking about throughout the book is the tensions which we still have between creativity and invention and some form of regulation. Not control, I do stress not control, because control by a central state is not a good idea, but some regulations, a bit like the sort of rules in games to set the framework. So in the early 18th century, they had a lot of problem with anonymous publications, which were very, very scurrilous, shades of social media today. But they realised you have to have some way of tracking who said what. So the libel laws come in, but also the publisher has to have his mark on the book. I mean, you can still produce things illegally and circulate those, but the publisher, they bring in the rules about the publisher must be identified. So the publisher can be pursued even if they can't find. And some, quite a lot of people do continue to publish anonymously, as Jane Austen initially did, but there are framework rules, and that is exactly the dilemma. You want to be able to talk about everything, but you don't want a torrent of absolute misinformation and public hatreds. So that was one of the things that the 18th century debates were about, very similar to the debates today. And my own prediction, this is nothing to do with the 18th century, some framework regulations for social media must be coming. They will need some international cooperation, but they're coming. I'm sure of that.
Yeah, probably in the same way they came for the anonymous gossip columnist in the 18th century. Yes. Yeah. Well, Eliza Haywood did end up in prison, but maybe for something else. So we've mentioned Scarlett's publications, and I think it would be remiss to talk about the 18th century without probably talking about the Age of the Libertine and the rake's progress, and you mentioned Hogarth's prints of the rake's progress and the harlot's progress in your book as well. How did the figure of the libertine come about?
Yes, sex and the Georgians. And it can't be said that they invented sex. We have pretty good evidence from the continuation of the human species that people had come across this before. But the 18th century is the big, great age when it all comes into the open and is discussed, written about. It's there in prints, in plays, in songs. Some of the things now are, you know, quite hair-raising by the later Victorian standards. The Victorians had something of a reaction against that. But it's to do with the spread of literacy, the spread of the freedom of the press, as we've just been mentioning, and also not the complete disappearance, but the decline of the church courts as actually invigilating people's social behaviour. So some of it is just lifting the lid on things that have already been happening, but some of it is also, as you can imagine, the more things are talked about and discussed, it's also an encouragement to experimentation. And it's hard to say exactly how, you know, what the earlier history of lesbianism is, but we know much more about it from the 18th century onwards. Can't say it was invented then, but or the gay male subculture in the 18th century, extremely vigorous, and it's officially disapproved of, partly winked at, and the number, there are prosecutions indeed, but far short of the whole total number of gay activities happening. And one of the things that then becomes a source of, a justified source of complaint, is that the law then is so capricious, because lots of gay men and women, well, no, women aren't prosecuted for this, but lots of gay men are getting away with things and a few are prosecuted. And that, yeah, how unfair can that be? So it produces not only a discussion about all the varieties of sexual behaviour, but also how, what society's attitude should be. And again, you do need some legal frameworks against wife beating or the abuse of minors. Well, or indeed against some forms of even now, say, erotic self-abuse. Some of these are legally forbidden. So you need some ultimate framework. So it's partly because society is grappling with all these that it's such an interesting period to read about. And some of the novels, again, are startlingly frank, or interestingly frank. But again, we mustn't make out that it's all too simple, because some of these novels are officially banned and are kept as clandestine. So there is a sort of counteraction of shock horror that's going on at the same time. But one of the things that's very interesting, for example, the advent of the male libertine and the hellfire clubs caused tremendous shock, scandal, all the rest, but they're never prosecuted, either before a church court or a legal court, and a secular court, and they have men of high social standing. But there is a bit of a tide against unfettered male libertinage, because it is oppressing women. So there's all these debates coming through. You can't just let rip on everything without weighing up. It's a bit like my point about trial and error. You try and experiment, but sometimes they have unforeseen consequences. So there's a sort of feminist or proto-feminist sense coming through of paying attention to the wishes and interests of women. And they're often, not all variably, of course, but often at odds with the most extreme male freedom to do absolutely everything they want.
Yeah, and there is the development of the female libertine, but not in the same sense, you know, in the kind of like celebrity courtesan type figure, but it's not exactly the same, is it?
No. But no, they are very interesting too for the assertion of female claims and rights in all of this. And Henriette Wilson's memoirs are still in print. She is the one when Wellington said, publish and be damned. And his reputation was great enough to survive the exposition of their affair. But she at least is asserting her right to sort of give her, have her voice, as we would say in a 20th century way and 21st century way. And she, it's not an equal encounter, but she's at least asserting her right to appear. Funnily enough, some of these famous courtesans of the Georgian era, one does wonder what their great attribute was, because what some of them are famous for being famous, and it's really hard to tell in retrospect what that relates to, whereas others, in a more meritocratic sense, are actually very formidable women. Perdita Robinson began life as an actress and as a famous lover, but she ended up as a novelist and writer of, you know, great interest. So some of them have got a lot to them. In the celebrity world, you can be famous for being famous.
London's original It Girls, then, you know, St. Yes. James's Park, Whitehall, them all. Yeah. Yes. Real cool. Yes. To finish off, I'm going to ask a question that might be a bit too difficult in its scope, and I'm very sorry if it's a mean question, but throughout reading the book and talking to you about it, it becomes very clear that the long 18th century and the Georgians are such a hub of industry development. Almost everything feels like it's invented, so much fun, so much wildness. Why do you think that was a period of such development and progress and interest? Yeah,
it is a good question, and I have an answer that draws on many strands, some of which we've discussed. So I think some of it is to do any society that for the first time goes from very low to really quite extensive literacy unleashes a great upsurge of buried talent, as it were. So then this, many societies, when they go through the surge, the first surge of literacy, have this great buzz. But more than that, it's the integration of the three kingdoms, it's creating a much more extensive social hub, but also it is to do with trade, exploration, all the rest. Britain is, it's like being the Silicon Valley of its era. It's at the centre of exchange with Europe, exchange with the New World, exchanges all around Africa, the far India, of course, tremendous stirring of interest and excitement, and the first embassy to China. So there's this sense of being at the hub of the world, as well as everything else, literacy, the three kingdoms, and world contacts. And I love to cite in that context one of the 18th century's most famous novels, Gulliver's Travels. Swift hadn't done any of that, you know, he hadn't travelled the world, just come between England and Ireland. But he was picking up on that sense of the romance of exploration. So Gulliver explores imaginary worlds. He ends up with Laputa, the floating island of scientists, doing mad experiments. But, you know, he picked up on this mood of exploration, extravaganza, dreaming, doing the impossible. And that's in the very early 18th century. So there's this, he picked up on that, and it became such a famous book, partly because he's picking up on something that's happening in society. And I love it that there's already children's versions of Gulliver Travels, mainly known as a children's book now, but by the within a couple of generations it's being written up as a children's book. And it's sort of the imagination as well as the reality of travel. And remember, of course, most of these Brits in the 18th century haven't travelled the world, but they'll have relatives or friends, and they're all writing to each other. We've got a lot of evidence now about letters, you know, unlike today's emails and all the rest, but they're writing letters. There's a tremendous exchange. So there's just this sense of being at a world hub. And it only happens, you know, when it happens. You can't make it happen. And it moves, you know, where are these global hubs move around the world? But this, the 18th century, was Britain's time. And there was a, actually, I told you there were all these writings, some of them saying woe and doom, and you know, the nation's, that's when we did badly against the French, there was a lot of woe and doom. But when we were doing well, and one of them wrote, our time is now. And it was.
Yeah, it definitely was for them. Thank you so much. That was so interesting.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Critic Books podcast. To never miss an episode, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.